I'm sure all of you are following the elections. How could you not be following the elections so closely? They're important enough. I mean, this is a very, very unusual, very, very important election. And I'm not a person who typically believes that elections make a great deal of difference. Every now and then, there are what I call regime change elections, regime change at home, when you get really deep systemic new directions, which is certainly possible in this election. So I'm looking forward to this conversation with you. I'm sure all of you are experts on this election. You've thought about it a lot. There are a lot of kind of historically really important precedents for this election in some way. And some things we've never seen before. I have written quite a bit about these things. I have actually 3 or 4 books coming out, but I brought over a few you might, because there's a book there called, I'll just show it to you, Hidden Power. I'm going to be talking a lot about fascism and socialism. This book came out a few years ago, but I kind of anticipated what we're dealing with, and it was nominated as one of the 3 best current events book in the United States by the independent publishers. Those of you who want to understand what's causing the economic crisis for the 99%, this is sort of a Reader's Digest version I did on Thomas Piketty, for those of you who know Piketty's work but didn't want to read through 700 pages of economic history. And then I've got a new book coming out in May called Bully Nation. I guess what I'd like to do is put this election in a little historical context and then get to how I see things unfolding. And I think the most telling, I mean, there are a lot of important historical contexts. But the one I want to focus on is Germany in 1932. Now, Germany, that was the election, of course, in which fascists came to power shortly after the election, and there were also major socialist and communist parties in play. There was a kind of division in Germany during the Weimar period, which was a republic after World War I, where there were kind of red state Germans and blue state Germans, major feminist gay and labor and other progressive movements in the context of a growing right-wing set of fascist groups, of which Hitler was just one of many in the 20s. But underneath all that in Germany was what you all know about, a massive economic crisis, which hit Germany when the Weimar Republic was established. The Weimar Republic was the first republic in Germany which came into being after World War I. It was immediately compromised by the reparation strategy of Britain and France and the United States, which sucked Germany with massive costs for the war, which almost immediately threw the German economy and the German working class into a complete catastrophe, and led to, on the one hand, the rise of these right-wing organizations, which we see echoes of today in Donald Trump and in the whole Republican Party, and in parts of the Democratic Party, actually. And on the other side, we saw a sort of rippling of all kinds of urban kind of political, social, countercultural movements. And it was almost like there were 2 Germanys, one in the hinterland and one in the cities. And you had this polarization of what were to become proto-fascist kinds of forces that would eventually take control in Germany in ways that nobody would have ever anticipated in the 20s, because they were running at 2%, 3% of the polls. And of course, Hitler was put in jail in 1923 when he wrote Mein Kampf. And you had a fairly large socialist and very large communist party, but one that was compromised very seriously by its relation to Stalinism. And underneath all this was what we're facing today, of course, in the United States, which is a really dramatic economic restructuring of the country, a kind of breakdown of the periods of capitalist economies when they tend to grow, and you see significant kinds of periods of rises in wages, rises in middle classes, and so forth. And in the Weimar, and especially after the 1929 crash in the United States, which immediately had major implications for Germany, because Germany was really floating in the late 20s. The economy had recovered from the hyperinflation which was a response to a lot of printing money by the German government when it couldn't pay back the reparations, and the Allies occupied much of Germany at that point, and there was a kind of a breakdown in taxation. The government couldn't, and the country really couldn't function. This was in the 1923, 1924. But the economy recovered when the United States began giving major loans to the Germans. And when the market crash hit in 1929, the United States pulled back those loans, which were really the basis on which the German economy was functioning. And the German economy, like the whole world, went into a massive economic collapse. And it hit particularly hard in Germany. And the German working classes were simply, you know, most jobs were destroyed, people were starving. I mean, there's literally hunger and mass, just a collapse of the German middle classes into the farmers in the rural areas into a, essentially an unviable situation, which would lead eventually to fascism. So when I think of the election today, I see a lot of parallels between what happened in Germany. They're not identical by any means. There are a lot of differences between the Weimar Republic and what we're seeing now. But there are enough parallels to scare you, to make you look carefully at that history, and to think about how this is likely to play out. And it's not all... It's terrifying, but it's not all terrifying, because there are many... I don't know if you guys saw the... Returns last night. Michael said that he doesn't watch the returns. How many of you watch the returns carefully? No. I mean, it gets. I have one of these obsessional minds. Once I start watching, I can't stop. You know, it's like my alcoholism it's just all in my politicals. So I follow these things very carefully. So Sanders won this massive, 80 to 20% victory in all three states that were. Being contested yesterday, and the Democratic race is not over. So you're seeing for the first time an American socialist, or a man who at least identifies himself as a socialist, with a significant challenge to Hillary Clinton and to what the Democratic Party has stood for. Now, I want to turn to the question of Trump. I want to start, basically I titled this talk, Fascism, Socialism, and the White Working Class Voter. Because I think we're on a kind of precipice where, given the really serious economic crisis of the country, you have what history has shown are conditions which can lead to dramatic shifts toward either the far right or the far left, or let's say the moderate left. And a great difficulty by the capitalist elites, that means corporate elites in Wall Street, the Koch brothers, the what Bernie Sanders likes to call the billionaire class of donors and so forth. You find, I think you find, history gives us good evidence to believe that you find under these conditions a very significant chance, even in fairly, you know, historically developed democratic countries. Of course, Germany was not that, did not have a very strong record in that regard, of a regime change in which an election can most elections mean very little, because the corporate elites in a capitalist society tend to manage pretty easily either the Democratic Party elites or the Republican Party elites that run. So we have these establishment where you have the sort of exercise of elections, but you don't have any real change, and people don't tend to vote because they recognize that whoever wins is not going to make much difference. In an election like this, when the economic crises have gotten worse, and you've seen certain historical developments of both the far right and on the left, elections really can matter. And so I want to sort of just spell that out. So let me start with fascism. And when I say fascism, what name comes to your mind when you're thinking of American politics today? Trump? Wallace. Okay, what about in the current elections?
Trump.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's... Possibly Cruz. Yeah. So the media, for the first time in a long time, the mass media has been talking about fascism in America, which is very unusual, because we've had, I guess the theme I want to suggest here is that Donald Trump is a very interesting character. I think he's likely, although it's unclear, of course, everything is surprising in this election, so we can't say anything with any authority. But certainly what's driven the mass media coverage, it's very good. Anderson Cooper, do you know how much Anderson Cooper makes these days for covering these elections at CNN? $11 million a year. Wolf Blitzer makes $6 million. So the mass media is loving this, and of course they love Trump because he brings everybody to the television because he's such an experienced reality show entertainer, and he's so provocative. But I think what I want to say generally is that Trump is really a creation of the party that's now trying to, the establishment party that's becoming afraid of him. Much as in Germany, the establishment elites that were running Germany were very afraid of Hitler, but ended up embracing him because they felt they could control Hitler and the Nazis more easily than they could control the communists and the socialists. So another interesting thing to just remember from the election of 32 is that the movement of Hitler, who jumped to very strong popularity only in 1930 and then in 1932, was one that the establishment was very concerned about but felt that they could control. And so they basically turned the country. Hitler never got more than 30-some percent, which is about what Trump is able to get in this country. That doesn't mean that he won't take more control. But I think that the thing that I want to, the basic argument I want to make about fascism, rather than, is that I think the proto-fascist, American-style fascism that you're seeing percolate here is not just about Trump. In fact, Trump is actually in some ways the most moderate in terms of substantive issues on everything from Planned Parenthood to ground trips in the Middle East to public investment in this country and so forth. In terms of substantive issues, he's more moderate than most of the rest of the Republican Party, which is actually much more frightening. So I guess what I want to say is that the fascist threat lies in a development in the Republican Party that's begun since the 60s. I sometimes feel very guilty as a activist from the 1960s that I played a role in the development of the new right, which really began the shift of the Republican Party toward a very extreme yeah, it was sort of, I guess, the symbol of this was the rise of Lee Atwater. You remember the name Lee Atwater? Mm-hmm. He was the guy who did the Willie Horton ad. And kind of framed, and when I think of it, symbolically framed, the rise of a Republican Party that would seek to rally white workers who were facing a massive collapse in their economic prospects, which is really, you know, the wage stagnation and the disappearance of jobs for the working class, really began to really see back 30, 40 years ago. But in the last 40 years, despite the great growth in, you know, number of hours being worked, number of people working per family and so forth, you're seeing basically a complete stagnation or decline, both in the wages of ordinary families, family incomes, and in availability of jobs and job security. The measure of this is not so much the official unemployment rate, which is flawed in many ways and has come down since 2008 to about 5%. What I would look at instead, the workplace participation rate, which is the percentage of the population that actually is in the workforce. Does anybody know what that is, roughly? So even with women having come into the labor force for the last 40 to 50 years, you now have only about 60% labor force participation rate. What that reflects is that millions of American workers have dropped out, right? Because they don't believe they can find a job. And they're not counted as unemployed, because in order to be officially counted as unemployed, you have to have been looking for a job in the last 2 weeks, right? And if you haven't looked for a job in the last 2 weeks because you've given up or you don't feel, you're going to not be counted as unemployed. There are a lot of other reasons why the unemployment rate is not a good measure. Even the labor force participation rate is not that great a measure, but think about the fact that close to 50% of people who need to be working are not working. And you get a measure of how serious this economic crisis is for the working classes in the United States. The other measure that you're all familiar with is that the inequality, I just want to sort of lay out the basic, and this is something that Piketty in his book, which is not a Marxist book, it's really a Keynesian critique of capitalism and why capitalism is such a profound inequality engine. So what we've seen is a fair amount of growth during this period that the working class has been sinking. When I say working class, it's what the mass media often mean, I call them middle class, working people who are not affluent or very rich. And almost all the money being produced, and it's a lot of it, over the last, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, is going to not the 1%, but the 1/10 of 1%. It's just an overwhelming concentration of wealth at the very top. And you're seeing millions of people who are working, desperately trying to get jobs, or working long hours, working two or three jobs, and so forth, who are suffering badly. Now, let me pull this to the question of fascism. This exactly, even a more serious economic crisis was happening in Germany after 1929. You could sort of think of this after 2008, but it really began before then. And again, I want to point out that these trends, which have been going on economically for 30 or 40 years, correspond to the rise of a general shift toward an extremely right-wing Republican Party, which is representing, you know, the white working class is voting about 65% Republican, particularly white men. I just want to lay out one thing you've probably seen about the situation of those voters. For the first time in American history, the life expectancy of white men between 40 and 55 is declining in the United States, right? People are dying, and that population are dying younger. They're doing that, it's partly because their economic situation feels so bad to them. They feel left out. They feel humiliated. They feel depressed, they're on drugs, there are all kinds of problems. And now there's been a more recent demographic finding that white men between 25 and 40 are also beginning to see high rates of suicide and other measures of extreme, adversity and hopelessness. So what happens with fascism under these? Why does fascism percolate and begin to gain traction in the population when this happens? I call it, if you look at what Hitler did, and which is the model of fascism, of course, what Hitler did was develop what I call the betrayal narrative. When people begin, when large parts of the population begin to suffer very deeply, they're looking for explanations. They want to know why this is happening to them. And what fascism does is it offers a clear, coherent, simple explanation of why this is happening, which has very little reality to the truth of what's happening, but has enormous emotional resonance. The thing about fascist and right-wing politics that we know is that the right has a way of tapping into the emotions that underlie politics, right? They're very, very good at speaking to the visceral, emotional, personal things that are churning around in people's stomachs and in people's hearts. And I think the left generally has been much less sophisticated in developing messages that carry both truth but emotional power and resonance. So what fascists are doing is offering an emotionally resonant interpretation of what's happening to this to the population, of particularly of white workers, who are the base of fascist politics. In Germany, it was the Aryan, with the white working class would be essentially the Aryan population that Hitler identified. It was a race-based phenomenon. And what the betrayal narrative, which is sort of the storyline of fascism, does, it says, well, our whole country, and that tends to be associated very often with feelings of race, whether that involves, in our country, you know, race, you know, African Americans or Hispanics, or, and also now immigrants, of course. It tends to argue that there are a set of foreign people infiltrating the country, or sort of eating into the wealth and moral integrity of the country. The word Hitler used was purity, which threatened the whole nation and threatened the whole sense of people's spiritual integrity. Hitler was a very spiritual, moral discourse. Fascism, it's important to remember that fascism speaks to people's moral and spiritual aspirations and to their sense of belonging to a nation, in this case a white Aryan nation. And the betrayal narrative, which has been a classical fascist narrative, says that there are a bunch of foreign influences outside the nation, the purity of the nation, that are going to destroy us and explain, that are sucking the vital juices and the vital essence and creativity of the population and the people, and have to be destroyed. Hitler's case through you know, a very, very major militaristic response to drive out across the world the non, and to allow the Aryan race to establish itself as the dominant race. And of course, Jews, and to a lesser degree Slavic people and so forth, were viewed as infiltrating. They were the immigrants and the so forth of that period, who were seen as dangerous. You had to build up walls, you had to exterminate these people. They were rapists and criminals, and they were basically leeches on the society. Now, the betrayal narrative also includes a internal fifth column linked to the external threat. In Germany, that included all the socialists and communists. There was a large communist party. There was a strong socialist party in parliament. And then it included, like I said, Germany was divided between, just like in the United States, between the cities and the sort of blue what you might call the blue parts of Germany. Like Berlin was during the 20s, late 20s, and well, all through the 20s, had an extremely strong feminist movement, extremely strong gay movement. There was experimental theater. There was a really progressive counterculture at the same time that there was this very far right movement going. And Hitler could identify these urban socialist, feminist kinds of trends as models of the fifth column that threatened the purity of the nation. And so that fifth column, these are the internal enemy who you should be afraid of, you should really be afraid of, and because they are destroying your essence as a people and the creative potential of the human race in some sense, which is what Hitler described only the Aryan race had to offer. So it produces a politics that's obviously very familiar to what Donald Trump is saying, because Trump is targeting, he's doing dog whistle racism, which the Republican Party has done for a long time, as in the Willie Horton ad and so forth, focusing on immigrants, of course, and then looking at the internal liberals and socialists and so forth who are representing essentially an alliance with this anti, sort of demonic, satanic threat to the integrity of American exceptionalism. Now, there's one other thing. So I believe that this, as the economic crisis has extended the last 30 or 40 years, and wealth in the country has been siphoned up to the 1% and above, and masses of people are finding that the American dream is gone for them. They can't do what Americans have always been able to do, which is live better than their parents. They're starting to live worse, particularly the younger generation, which I'll get to when I talk about Sanders. Trump is simply the product, in my view, of what the Republican Party has become over this 40 years of economic stagnation. Now, the new thing Trump offers is, one, his amazing charisma as a TV personality. And more important, the person who tried to understand this psychologically was Wilhelm Reich. Many of you know that name, right? One of many people who were fascinated with trying to understand what happened to civilized Europe when fascism came. Nobody ever imagined that this was possible and it would produce what it produced. And Reich wrote a very important book called The Mass Psychology of Fascism, which was an effort to understand why were white working class people turning and resonating emotionally and politically to fascism. And he argued that the problem with the left was that it hadn't understood that people's political way of understanding politics is not simply shaped by the economics of what was happening, although it was very important, but also by the larger cultural worldview that was being established in the society. So Reich paid a lot of attention to the German family and to the historical tradition of authoritarianism in German history and politics, which had been pre-existing in Germany for many, many years prior to Hitler. And the argument, I think, which is very important, it's worth going back and reading The Mass Psychology of Fascism. Because if Trump wins this election, which is certainly not impossible if he gets nominated, he'll cross over to a lot of independents and some Democrats and the Reagan Democrats. And remember, white workers have been voting Republican for years now in very large numbers. So he extends the Republican base much broader than we've seen even in the past. So I think that what you're seeing is a comparable, the part of the working class and the population that Trump is resonating with is that part that has, America is a very complicated culture because it has a democratic, very liberal, kind of free element to it, and it has a very authoritarian form. A lot of this is shaped by the school system and by the media. And the The white working class, there have been a lot of interesting sociological studies of the duality of the school system. Working class people go to schools where they're taught to obey, where discipline is the central concern, learning to essentially accept authority is a part of the school system that what working class people in the public schools tend to go to. Because we live in a high-tech economy, which requires a considerable amount of creativity and innovation and freedom, upper middle class and people going into the top of the business world or into the professions and so forth are given exposure to a much less authoritarian, much more free kind of educational system. So we get a culture in America where you get this kind of polarization of culture. And the sort of mass psychology of fascism is most resonant with the parts of the population that go to these more authoritarian school systems and then are slotted into work situations where they have to simply obey what their bosses tell them to do. Whereas people much higher on the economic ladder have much more autonomy over their work and are much less subject. So you get educated people much less psychologically responsive to the kind of authoritarian bullying trends that Trump represents. In other words, what I'm saying about the fascist element here is that what's distinctive about Trump is not his policies per se. I mean, some of them, are, I mean, he's there. But rather, the emotional and personal culture that he's creating and helping develop in the country, which is very, to me, very, very frightening. This man could take an awful lot of people and get them behind an exceedingly authoritarian agenda that we're seeing in relation to building walls and, you know, massive bombing. Even though he doesn't want to put, like I say, he's more progressive on foreign policy, arguably, than Hillary Clinton, in the sense that he's against, he said, the Iraq war, which she voted for, was a crime, and we never should have put American forces in there. But he's talking about using nuclear weapons to wipe out, you know, ISIS and so forth, right? So it's a very contradictory situation. But if he were to win, it would certainly introduce a level of authoritarianism that we haven't seen in a long time in terms of the culture. And political culture, political emotion is very, very important. And he's ready, as we know, to eliminate a lot of laws. He's told that the military won't accept waterboarding or anything worse than that, the Geneva Accords don't accept it, he says, we'll change those laws. You know, which is exactly what Hitler did, right? Hitler burned the Reichstag and then suspended all, you know, German laws. It's not that big of a stretch to imagine Trump doing that kind of thing. So I think we're in a situation where fascism is really a serious possibility. Now, let's go in a more hopeful direction. So we also have, for the first time in American history, a candidate, Bernie Sanders, who is a self-identified socialist and has enormous resonance, particularly among young people between the ages of 18 and 30 and even up to 35 and 40. And is turning out, Sanders is... Well, just a few things you probably know about him. Although he's running behind Hillary and he's got a tough challenge because the way the Democratic Party is structured is that it's organized to ensure a corporate candidate. So the superdelegates constitute, up to about 20-25% of the total delegate race. But despite all the obstacles that he faces from the Democratic corporate establishment. These are the same people that kept Henry Wallace from getting on. Remember, in 1944, we might not have had a Cold War. The vice president of the... Everybody knew in 1944 that Roosevelt was going to die within a year. He had really high blood pressure. His heart condition was bad. And Henry Wallace was the vice president. Both Eleanor and FDR wanted Wallace, who was a socialist who wanted solidarity with the Soviet Union. The corporate elites threw him out, despite the will of... And it's a sign of how strongly both parties have become controlled by this elite of the society that basically manages both parties. And you're going to see things at the Republican Party and maybe at the Democratic Party. They're going to be so eye-opening. I'm just learning myself some of the arcane rules of the rules committees of these conventions and the delegate processes, which are going to completely skew how delegates who are voted for by one candidate may go for another candidate, even in the first ballot. There are a lot of unbound ballot delegates who are not even bound on the first ballot to vote for the person that they were signed up for. In any case, you've got something we have not really seen before. That is, we've seen, of course, there was Eugene Debs, there was Wallace, there have been people on the left who kind of were far-left New Dealers or were socialists who have had a certain amount of influence. But never have we had a candidate who has created the popular enthusiasm that Bernie Sanders has. Let me just give you a few details. First of all, he's gotten now over 6 million individual contributors, averaging, as you know, $27 a donation. He has no super PAC. He's taking no money from Wall Street. He's also now gotten approximately 1 million people to come to his rallies during the current election. Nobody has ever done that before. Have 1 million people turn out. Now, again, this is not a new thing. It's not a new thing for Bernie. If you look at his speeches when he was running for mayor in Burlington, Vermont, in 1980, he was saying, the speeches are exactly the same. Bernie's been saying this. One of the reasons for his appeal is that, unlike all other politicians, he just is so deeply, is what he's talking about, that nobody has to doubt the sincerity, authenticity, or what he really would like to do, right? And he's been absolutely clear and honest, and I don't think he's capable of thinking anything different. He's learning things. I think he's learning things about the relation between Black Lives Matter protesters. I think had a big effect on him, and thinking about more closely about the relation between race and class and so forth. But the man is bringing out a version of kind of social democracy, European social democracy, and sort of moderate socialism, you might call it, which is very powerful and is attracting to young people. It's also, interestingly, attracting a certain sector of the white working class that's been voting Republican for a long time. Now, there's been a lot of interesting literature about this. By the way, one thing I just want to add about the young people and so forth before I get to that. But the word socialism over the last 40 years has been pulled endlessly. I've written a number of op-eds on this. And what's remarkable is that the American population over the last 30 to 40 years, when this economic crisis has begun, have begun to shift their emotional association to the words socialism and capitalism. So like 10 years ago, socialism was a word that was viewed positively by a small percentage of the population. Now, over 50% of the American population say they could vote for a socialist candidate. This has been building. I followed with a bunch of polls that were coming out like 7 or 8 years ago, well before the race and so forth, where young people in particular, about a majority were saying they saw socialism as better than capitalism when they just heard those words. And we don't know exactly, of course, in polls what people are thinking of when they hear those words, but they were putting that way. Now you've got something like 70% of young people saying they find socialism a more attractive idea than capitalism. You've got, in the population in general, a shift toward a favorable association with the word socialism. This reflects the economic, people seeing the realities of what Piketty describes as capitalism, the way capitalism, this is not deviant capitalism, this is the way capitalism is programmed to operate. It is a system that divides very wealthy people who own a lot of money and means of production from most people who are increasingly disenfranchised economically. This is capitalism. And this is not just academic, BS. It's what young people are starting to realize as they go to school, that promise that they're going to do well, and they're coming out of colleges with very significant amounts of student debt, and facing a job market that looks very unfavorable to them. So they're not getting what they're invested in. And the whole expectations of the American dream are being challenged, and this is producing a massive upheaval for a generation that's been viewed as passive, conservative, and so forth. The reality is, over a substantial period of time, if you just look at the way the polls are showing, the millennial generation is the most progressive generation since mine in the 60s and 70s, and of young people. And they've been very responsive to this. And this also reflects the fact, of course, that many of these young people are coming into educational systems which have that less authoritarian, more free and expressive, and where you've seen, you know, move identity politics on the left, that is, the left become largely a politics not of class, but of race and gender and sexual orientation, which includes a lot of ideas about inclusiveness, expressiveness, countercultural ideas which involve, quote, challenging authority and so forth. So on the other, so you're seeing, at the same time that you're seeing this frightening rise in, you know, this far-right fascist culture, you're seeing a parallel rise. It should be said, the mass media is not reporting this. Like, if you have to choose, if you're a mass media, between reporting on Trump and reporting on Sanders. We had a good example of it 2 days ago, that they were waiting for Trump to come out. He waited a long time. The podium was empty. Sanders was in the middle of a talk, I think in, I don't remember if it was in Portland or somewhere. He had like 30,000 people there. They weren't covering it. They were waiting for Trump, right? They were showing an empty dais and an empty podium when they could have been covering Sanders. There have been studies of how much the mass media has covered Sanders versus Trump and Hillary. And it's been, you know, massively skewed toward a reporting on Trump and secondarily on Hillary Clinton. So this has helped skew the dynamics of what we're seeing. But the hopeful thing here is that the younger generation is being exposed to the hard edge of capitalist realities, which is that they are being propelled, even when they've worked hard and gone into debt for serious education, into an economic system where they're not going very far, and they know it. I teach these students every day. I know how they're thinking. They see how the system is operating against them. So in a sense, they're becoming working class, middle class, college-educated people who have been exposed to forms of critical thinking and non-authoritarian culture are becoming working class. At the same time, and there's almost an industry on trying to understand the white working class voter in political science and sociology, who are polling working class people. And what they're finding is that the working class, the white working class vote, is very complicated to understand. On the one hand, there's this huge resonance to this race-based, hyper-nationalistic, jingoistic kind of thing that draws them to the right, which says we're being betrayed by the government's going toward minorities, not standing up to outside threats, and so forth and so on. On the other hand, they see that they're working long hours, two jobs, can't find a job, and their incomes haven't raised, well, the very top is going off the charts. You know, I mean, that's amazing. You know, the 40 most wealthy people in the United States have more wealth than like about 50% of the whole population. I mean, the wealth is just becoming absurdly concentrated. And they see that. They're not idiots. And makes them wonder. And they saw what happened about, you know, when Wall Street began taking these vast risks, what happened? They got bailed out by their tax dollars. And they're wondering why they're not getting bailed out. We have a country in which capitalism means socialism for the rich because their risks are being covered by the state. And capitalism for everybody else, right? You're on your own. And the students are smart enough to understand that. So you have the foundation for a large, educated, young population which is orienting toward a more progressive, you know, socialist kind of politics. So, let me conclude, because I know I'm taking too much time here, Brian, so I'll go a little bit faster, with how are people going to make this choice? And we don't know. We don't know. One, we may, I mean, here are the options that we're facing today. We're facing a Republican Party that is in horrible trouble right now, right? They don't get Trump, they get Cruz. They hate Cruz as much as we hate Cruz. Cruz is, I'm hoping Cruz gets nominated because I think he'll be the most. But you're going to still have these authoritarian forces in the population. They're scary. And like I say, there's a possibility that Trump will win and do. There was a book written a number of years ago, and this book, Hidden Power, I read about it a lot. What would fascism look like in America? A book called Friendly Fascism, one way. I'm not sure if it looks so friendly these days, but it's a real possibility, right? The second possibility is that you could get a post-Sanders. I think it's unlikely, given the way the corporate, just like with Henry Wallace, the way that the Democratic Party is structured and funded and so forth, the way the delegate selection process works in the conventions, that even if, you know, Sanders were to surprise and do really, really well in terms of the delegate math in the remaining states, he's going to get shut out by the superdelegates. But Hillary can't win without getting a massive buy-in from Elizabeth Warren, Sanders, and that whole campaign. So you're going to see a different kind of Democratic Party being driven partly by the base. I want to say one other thing about Sanders. Sanders comes out of the Occupy movement. I don't mean Sanders himself, but the movement. Turns out that the race back in 2012, 2013, the Occupy people were wondering, how did we translate this into a political revolution against Wall Street? This is the Occupy Wall Street movement, and so forth. They said, we need a candidate. They were thinking of Elizabeth Warren. But Warren was not ready. You know, she was just starting out as a senator. And they immediately, when there was a little bit of sign that Bernie Sanders, this is back 2 or 3 years ago, way before the race, it was the Occupy online people who helped create Occupy that started a national movement online thing for Bernie Sanders. So it's important to remember that Sanders is less important in a way as a Democratic Party figure than as an expression of grassroots social movements that have been very fragmented but have begun to find, both in terms of climate activism and a range of other, you know, really global unifying issues, including, of course, the economy, a kind of more unified structure. Now, I'll conclude with this. This is exceedingly important because what happened in Germany was the very progressive elements in Germany, which included a large number of socialists and communists, as well as feminists and all kinds of other identity, progressive cultural identity movements, never consolidated. They never coalesced. And so the left remained a very fragmented set of social forces in Germany. If they had come together, they could have stopped fascism. But they basically, a lot of them stayed out of the electoral arena. They ceded it to the aristocracy in Germany and to the far right of Hitler's groups, and they those won. Now, I think there's a lesson for this. I'm actually doing a book right now, which is being supported. Ironically, interesting, I have a guy who likes my writing who's a grandson of Henry Wallace. And who is giving me support for writing a series of new books on these issues I'm talking about right now, which is about how the social movements of our country have gone astray in terms of this issue of fragmentation being scattered. It's not that we don't have a lot of movement in this country. It's that they kind of don't coalesce in a way that can build and become visible and become powerful on the national and global political scene. And so, and identity politics, that is the identity of race and gender and sexual orientation, when it's stripped away from class politics, can become very counterproductive.
The same is true of class politics when it's stripped away from focus on gender and race and sexual orientation and so forth. So in this new book I'm working on, I'm looking at this relation and the kinds of social movements that have a foundation. If you really understand the system we're up against, there's no way that you can disentangle class and race and sex, nor that you can disentangle capitalism from climate change, from militarism, and all the other issues. Those are all kind of, I call these universalizing movements, movements which see the connections and connect the dots. It's very interesting that Michelle Alexander, who's written this book, a black writer who's the most important writer on mass incarceration and the prison system, has been saying, you know, I spent my whole life writing about this. She's written this massive, wonderful, best-selling book that's just come out a couple of years ago, and she says, I'll never stay in this lane again before because I'm not talking, I've been divorcing the question of judicial reform and African-American injustice from the question of capitalism and environmentalism and so forth. And so she's saying, I'm never going to do this again. So there's a kind of, there's emerging within the social movements a conversation about how these movements are connected and how they can work together. And again, I raise this because I think it is the best possibility for the future. There's a large population out there, both among the young people and among the working class. I don't expect you'll ever get a significant part of the white male working class back. But remember, because one, the unions have been broken. White working class people who have been in unions or in other community institutions which offer them a place to belong. Remember, the emotional and social foundation of this whole dangerous thing is the atomization and loss of people's sense of connection to something that makes them feel they're part of something and that they matter, that they're important, they're worthwhile. That comes when you're part of a set of organizations, whether they're unions, whether they're social movements, whether they're churches, whether they're parts of your community, that offer people that sense of emotional grounding. They're not anchor babies. They're being anchored in a sense of reality and community to a larger set of purposes. And that's what these movements, including the labor movement, has to reconstruct in this country. So what I conclude from this is that the future is very fluid. You know, there are possibilities that are terrifying, and there are possibilities that are very hopeful. And a great deal has to do with how we organize, how we take. In the last 40 years, the ascendancy of a far-right Republican Party is because you've had a lot of money and a lot of anger that's been translated into political action and movements on the Tea Party, the far right, the Koch brothers, and so forth, which have turned a small minority of people, largely based in the South, and are running a kind of the Lee Atwater Southern Strategy into a massive national movement. The progressive movements are just as powerful, but they need to be organized in a new way. And I think if we do take on that challenge, we have a good chance of making things a lot better and to avoid the most terrifying possibilities that we're facing. Thanks for putting up with this longer talk. And